Welcome. Thank you very much for coming today. My name is Eric Berger. I teach here at the College of Law, and I'm delighted. And I'm delighted to welcome you to another event in our multi-year series on the law and democracy. This series addresses the degradation of democracy in the United States and abroad, the depolarization in American political culture, and the role that we have as lawyers and law professors in preserving and thinking about democracy and the rule of law. I also want to thank the many people who helped make this event possible. Specifically, this series has provided generous support from the late Barb and from Ron Schaefer. I also wanted to thank Katie Fannin-Steele in the Dean's Office for her tremendous work organizing this, and Richard McDermott for assisting with all the technological side of things. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Professor Bruce Ledowitz, who is the Adrian Van Kam Endowed Chair in Scholarly Excellence and a Professor of Law at the Thomas R. Klein School of Law of Duquesne University. Professor Ledowitz teaches in the areas of state and federal constitutional law, so you know what he has to say is going to be interesting, and jurisprudence, specializing in law and religion and law and the secular. Professor Ledowitz is co-director of Duquesne's Klein Pennsylvania Constitution website. In 1981, he founded the Allegheny County Death Penalty Project, which he directed for 13 years. He also co-founded the Western Pennsylvania Coalition Against the Death Penalty and served from 1985 to 1990 as secretary of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. He's the past winner of the Allegheny County Bar Association Pro Bono Service Award, the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Liberty Award, the Marjorie Mattson Civil Liberties Award, and the inaugural Dr. John and Liz Murray Award for Excellence in Faculty Scholarship in 2012 and again in 2017. In addition to law review publications, Professor Ledowitz writes regularly in a variety of popular journals and magazines. He's the author of four books, including American Religious Democracy, Hallowed Secularism, Church, State, and the Crisis in American Secularism, and most recently, a book from Oxford University Press entitled The Universe is on Our Side, Restoring Faith in American Public Life. Professor Ledowitz received his undergraduate degree from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and his JD from Yale Law School. I'm also happy to report that I had the pleasure of having dinner with him last night, and he's also a delightful fellow. Please join me in welcoming to Nebraska, Professor Bruce Ledowitz.
Thank you. I want to thank you all very much for this opportunity. The faculty and students of the Nebraska College of Law, Dean Moberly, Eric Berger, and the Nebraska Law Review, which will publish an expanded version of this talk, for the opportunity to address this most important topic, the breakdown in American public life and its rescue. We love to say that we are defending democracy. The phrase is so popular that the Association of American Law Schools, the AALS, chose defending democracy as the theme of the 2024 annual meeting just 2 months ago. Nevertheless, in our responses to the crisis in American public life, we are not defending democracy for three reasons. First, we are not a democracy. Our system of governance is not democracy. It is, as this Nebraska Law School series puts it, law and democracy, or as we usually call it, constitutional democracy. Democracy by itself has never been the American goal. Many dictatorial regimes have been able to claim that they reflect popular will. Hitler was very popular until after the fall of France. Instead of democracy, Americans have aimed at creating a basically representative system of government in which the rights of the minority are protected and the rule of law is respected, a constitutional democracy. So the AALS should have chosen as its slogan, defending constitutional democracy. There is a second and even more fundamental problem with the phrase defending democracy, and that is that our political opponents also claim to be defending democracy. They loudly insist that we, and not they, are the threat to democracy. Democrats say that Republicans are the threat to democracy because of their voter suppression, their partisan gerrymandering, and of course, their efforts to overturn the result of the 2020 presidential election. But it is worth noting that the protesters on January 6 who stormed the Capitol also believed they were defending democracy. And Republicans today say that Democrats are trying to keep their favored candidate for president, former President Donald Trump, off the ballot precisely because they are afraid that he will win election, an effort that failed, as you probably have heard, but will continue probably in Congress. Everybody claims to be defending democracy. That is why the phrase is empty in our current situation. But the third reason we should abandon the phrase defending democracy is the most fundamental of all. With its suggestion of fighting our enemies, remember Donald Trump told the rally before the attack on the Capitol to fight like hell, defending democracy is absolutely the worst way to try to resolve the crisis in American public life. Democracies do not flourish by fighting. We learned what the foundation of a healthy democracy is in the well-known 2018 book, How Democracies Die, by the political scientists Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. According to Levitsky and Ziblatt, democracy is a shared practice that rests not primarily on law, but on formal and informal norms and practices. In a healthy democracy, these norms can be reduced to one underlying directive, forbearance. Forbearance means that politicians do not pursue political advancement by any means possible. Instead, they play by the rules, they accept defeat, knowing that they will have another chance next time to regain power. Once political norms violations begin, however, a downward spiral develops in which a violation by one side feeds a feeling of justified response by the other side, leading to catastrophic and dangerous results that lead people to believe that political disagreements are ultimate rather than relative and contingent. As the authors write, when parties view one another as mortal enemies, the stakes of political competition heighten dramatically. Losing ceases to be a routine and accepted part of the political process and instead becomes a full-blown catastrophe. When the perceived cost of losing is sufficiently high, politicians will be tempted to abandon forbearance. Acts of constitutional hardball may then, in turn, further undermine mutual toleration, reinforcing beliefs that our rivals pose a dangerous threat. The result is politics without guardrails, a cycle of escalating constitutional brinkmanship. Well, this describes America to a T, but what is the solution? You feel your opponents really are mortal enemies. Their success really is a full-blown catastrophe. And of course, you are right. Your political opponents are despicable. They are, as presidential candidate Hillary Clinton put it in 2016, a basket of deplorables. I can only assure you that your opponents feel exactly the same way about you. All of this fighting is a dead end. It will not save constitutional democracy. Seeing ourselves surrounded by enemies and fighting them is why America is so angry today. As a New York Times column put it, this is why we are so grumpy. And this is related to the reason President Joe Biden does not get more credit for a pretty good economy. Biden gets less credit than he might because Americans are pessimistic and distrustful generally. We expect bad things in the future. That makes forbearance difficult. We don't even have faith that there will be a next election in which to regain power. There is an answer to all this. The answer is not to feel that way. After all, it is exaggerated. Studies show that we perceive our political opponents as much more extreme than they are, and the country is not going to hell, no matter which party wins the presidency in 2024. Things are actually pretty good right now, except for our politics. But how can I say that? What about all the racism, police brutality, wealth inequality, war in the world, attacks on learning and public education, the loss of the constitutional right to abortion, and on and on? I say to you here that on most of these matters, things are far better than we perceive. Just compare the national outrage over the killing of George Floyd in 2020 with the way that the murder of black men had previously been treated in America. Even Trump said it doesn't get any worse than that. Now, I am not discounting Donald Trump, who may be just as dangerous as Democrats fear. But many Republicans feel exactly the same way about him. Anyway, Trump isn't our only problem. Things were going badly in American public life before he came on the scene. So, how do we stop feeling this way? How do we become more accepting of our differences? How do we de-escalate our politics? We cannot do that as an act of will. We cannot just feel better. Mark Alexander, the dean of Villanova Law School, suggests that the way to renew our politics is by listening to the people with whom we disagree. Or, in the words of the mission statement of my own law school, Duquesne Klein, we must promote democratic discourse. Yes, that is the proper response to the crisis in American public life. But now you are sitting there in complete skepticism, and I don't blame you. Listening to each other is exactly the kind of thing we find it difficult and unrewarding to do. The advice to listen sounds like asking, why don't we just get along? Forbearance only works if it is natural, organic, second nature. It cannot be a learned technique. Forbearance must flow out of our deepest commitments. It must be forbearance without having to think about it. That is, after all, how it used to be. Thus, the title of this address, Planting Law and Democracy in Sustainable Soil. What we are looking for to heal public life is the sustainable soil of forbearance and thus of constitutional democracy. What is the necessary condition for people to practice forbearance, listening to each other, accepting the election of opponents, or generally, as Abraham Lincoln put it in his first inaugural address, being friends, not enemies? What is the sustainable soil of that political friendship? When we know that, then we can try to plant or replant constitutional democracy in that sustainable soil. Now, I know what that sustainable soil used to be called. It used to be called religion. I am thinking here of Justice William Douglas's famous description of American constitutional democracy in 1952 in his majority opinion in Zorach versus Clausen, the public school release time case. Douglas wrote, "We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being." I have taught that opinion for 40 years, and it has only recently occurred to me that these words make no sense. The federal constitution does not presuppose a supreme being and was widely criticized for just that reason when it was proposed. Unlike other constitutions of the time, the federal constitution neither thanked nor acknowledged God. Our constitution was secular. Yet, I think in a deeper sense, and possibly Douglas's inchoate assumption, he was absolutely right. God was the sustainable soil of constitutional democracy at the start of the Republic and continued to be. To see this, we must look at another classic text of our constitutional democracy, John Adams' letter to the Massachusetts militia in 1798. Adams wrote, again in words we all know, "Our constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Similarly, in another classic formulation, George Washington had asserted in his farewell address 2 years earlier, in 1796, that of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. What did Adams and Washington mean? Actually, Adams made it quite clear what he meant, and it is a lesson we are relearning currently. Adams was referring to the limits of law, including the Constitution. Adams explained, "Because we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion, avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net." In other words, if you have to file lawsuits and bring criminal cases to stop a person like Donald Trump from being elected president, your constitutional democracy is already tottering. It is already not planted in sustainable soil. Constitutional democracy must be rooted in something deeper than law. Constitutional democracy relies on non-legal commitments to sustain itself. Socially, these are the norms that Levitsky and Ziblatt describe, especially forbearance. Personally, these are the habits that Washington invoked. They are sometimes called habits of virtue. But how is Douglass's supreme being presupposed by these commitments? In the case of religion and morality, Adam's assumption is that God demands the personal habits of rectitude that rein in raw ambition. Washington himself embodied that hope by his surrender of office after two terms. In terms of forbearance, the social norm, religion teaches not only that creation is good, but so are people. Or, insofar as we are all sinners, we are at least all in the same boat. There is common ground among us, and we have no reason to view our opponents as enemies. In addition to religion as the foundation of social and personal norms, the crux of the political commitment under religion is that God is Lord of history. This was the basis for the commitment of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. My temporary political setback is not ultimate. Justice will triumph in the long run. That is what makes forbearance palatable. I can live with the fact that my opponents are temporarily in power. And of course, it is always the case that both my opponents and I are only partially on the side of history. Neither one of us may truly claim to embody justice, so I have to be humble about my own commitment. I cannot so readily speak of my opponents as them. I have to think of politics as us, as Dr. King did. I have the responsibility to speak to my opponents and convince them, as Dr. King counseled, not just beat them in a game of power. I have to assume that all of America will respond to the call of justice. Dr. King's formulation also reminds us that there is an assumed ontology at work here, as well as a theory of history. Justice must be real in some sense for Dr. King's saying about the moral universe to be coherent. That is, the foregoing account assumes that the universals, the good, the true, the beautiful, and the just, have power in history because they are, in some sense, real. We see this assumption at work in Justice Douglas in two other majority opinions. Skinner versus Oklahoma in 1942, the forced sterilization case, and Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, the marital contraception case. In Skinner, the Supreme Court protected the right of procreation, which Douglas called one of the basic civil rights of man, by which he presumably meant all human beings. This description carefully avoids any grounding of rights in positive law, including the constitutional text. The civil rights of people are not given by any human authority. They are inherent. It is a natural law formulation dependent on what can be understood as ontological realism. Similarly, in Griswold, Douglas again relativizes positive law, including the constitutional text, by invoking a right of privacy older than the Bill of Rights. These are rights we have by virtue of being human and living in this universe. This is all a part of C.S. Lewis's doctrine of objective value. The doctrine of objective value is the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. Lewis called this view the Tao because all traditional value systems shared this viewpoint. In the Tao, values can be analyzed empirically, as really so or not, as really consistent with the way things are or not. In the same way that our politics are dependent on objective value, the rule of law that is necessary for constitutional democracy is also dependent on objective value. Just as we do not despair that our political opponents attain power temporarily because we have faith in the ultimate triumph of justice, just so we do not abandon the courts just because a temporary judicial majority arrives at unjust results. As Justice Harlan wrote in his dissent in Poe versus Ullman, an earlier contraception case, a decision by this court which radically departs from the tradition could not long survive. Harlan assumed that injustice is temporary, even though, like Plessy versus Ferguson, it may last a long time. All of this, religion and its companion commitments, have been the sustainable soil of American constitutional democracy. And now it is all gone. The absence of these commitments is why Stephen Smith was concerned in his book, Law's Quandary, in 2004, that our modern or postmodern ontology was no longer consistent with the rule of law. Smith was afraid that lawyers had, as a group, lost the sense of the objectivity of the good, the beautiful, the just, and of truth. The way we put this now, Smith was afraid that we were living in a post-truth age that was inconsistent with the rule of law. There was no obvious way to criticize any judicial decision as being unjust or poorly reasoned, because the only reality was power. In ontological terms, forces and matter. As federal appellate judge Harvey Wilkinson put it, it may no longer be possible to judge a Supreme Court ruling by anything other than results. Now, in 2004, Smith did not despair. Somehow, lawyers just lived with this inconsistency. That is, we talked like common law lawyers about law and its coherence, even though lawyers really lack the ontological categories to justify talking that way. But today, we can see that law professors really have lost faith in the rule of law. In May 2021, the AALS hosted a symposium called the Conference on Rebuilding Democracy and the Rule of Law. But the rule of law was not defended at that symposium. Political enemies were simply called out. Granted, it was not until Dobbs overruled Roe versus Wade that law professors as a group were willing to proclaim publicly that law was just power, and that the conservatives had grabbed that power under Trump, a six-justice conservative majority, but law professors say it now. This is the reason people are willing to talk about packing the court, about age limits, about term limits, and all the rest, because the loss of judicial independence is not a harm if the court is just another political actor. Indeed, there should be no judicial independence if law is just politics and politics is just power. My good friend Eric Siegel has captured this new law professor candor in his provocative essay, Teaching Constitutional Law in a Legal Realist World. This candor is new, but the idea that law is just power is not new. Even before Smith's book, back in 1997, Justice Antonin Scalia, in his book, A Matter of Interpretation, had announced the victory of legal realism and had given it his approval. In writing about Madison and the role of the judiciary in the Constitution, Scalia wrote this: Madison wrote in an era when the prevailing image of the common law was that of a pre-existing body of rules uniform throughout the nation that judges merely discovered rather than created. It is only in this century, with the rise of legal realism, that we came to acknowledge that judges in fact make the common law and that each state has its own. And it is pretty clear that for Scalia, this making of the law is the act of power that legal realism considers it to be. It is not the unfolding of justice. There is absolutely no sense in Scalia of Harlan's tradition, that is, a rational continuum that makes demands on its practitioners. And the same commitments were present in the justices who opposed Scalia. That is why I wrote in 2015 a Law Review article that argued that in a five-day period in June 1992, every justice on the court joined an opinion that stated pretty expressly that all values were just human constructs, joined either the Scalia dissent in Casey or Justice Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion in Lee versus Weissman. I called this five-day period the 5 days in June when values died in American law. The decline of objective value is also why living constitutionalism, which depended on a vision of reason and history, has essentially disappeared. This is where we are after the death of God. We are not committed anymore to objective value, and as a result, everything has fallen to pieces. Culturally, we live in a desert of meaninglessness and valuelessness. What is to be done? The sustainable soil of religion and morality in their traditional form is no longer present. Yes, there are religious lawyers, but the culture is secular. And its secularism is nihilistic. You cannot plant constitutional democracy in that kind of desert soil. It is not sustainable. Now, normally, an address about law and democracy would just end here, with a warning about where we are and an injunction that change is needed, but no program. I am not going to leave you here with just critique and no program, all hat and no cattle, as you might say. What matters is how to get out of this crisis. I am proposing here a program for law schools in three steps to enrich the sustainable soil of constitutional democracy and then to plant us in it. Step one is to recognize that this, the loss of objective value after the death of God, is the source of the crisis in American public life, including law. It is not uniquely bad people doing unprecedentedly bad things. It is a loss of faith that affects us all. This recognition has proved much more difficult than I expected. In fact, I've not been able really to get beyond this point of recognition in my whole career. Our secular culture denies the critique of meaninglessness, despite all the evidence, despite the deaths of despair, despite the lack of a unifying story of existence in our culture, despite the absence of unifying cultural rituals. Secular culture insists that there cannot be a crisis in meaning because we humans make our own meaning. In other words, we just have to admit that our purposes in life are important to us, but are not important to the universe, which is neutral or indifferent to normative standards. We care about meaning and purpose. Indeed, humans are driven by meaning and purpose, but nothing else in reality is like that. We have to just admit it and get over it. But this secular view makes no sense. Given evolution, how could humans have this special place, apart and different from everything else? We have evolved to be consistent, consistent with the universe that made us. If we are value-driven, then in some sense, the universe must be value-driven as well. As Brian Swimmey says in the documentary, The Journey of the Universe, we are descended from a fish, which contrary to the practices of other fish, did not eat her young. And apart from the unpersuasiveness of viewing humans as the only normative entity in the universe, the idea that we make our own meaning does not work. That is not how meaning happens. The theologian William Desmond points out that if the universe is valueless, then your so-called values are valueless too. Just a whim you happen to have. In other words, you can be good without God. Certainly, I am not a religious believer myself. But you cannot be good without the good. You cannot be an artist without beauty. You cannot be a lawyer without justice. And you cannot practice constitutional democracy without truth. We certainly know that now. So step one, admit that we really do have a spiritual problem. Step two is to require law school faculty to announce and defend our commitments to the rule of law. Law schools, which are a key support of American constitutional democracy, are going to have to become places where questions of value, of philosophy, and theology again come to the fore. Away with these law school trade schools that we have become. And indeed, away with all this emphasis on pedagogy. Suddenly, the question is not how well do you teach, but what do you have to teach? What is your answer to the crisis of meaning? Do you really believe in the rule of law? And what do you mean by that? I am retiring next year, but I cannot wait to see how the tenure process will change under this understanding of the role of law schools. Now, this may sound like I am insisting on ideological uniformity, love ontological realism, or leave the academy. I don't mean that at all. As far as I am concerned, the enemy, and I mean that literally since it is not a person, that is the condition that has permitted untruth and disinformation to dominate public life is not nihilism per se, but reflexive nihilism. Nihilism as assumed to be so obvious that one does not need to think about it or confront it or defend it. Reflexive nihilism is our default position. Reflexive nihilism is our current unsustainable soil. That is the enemy. I have in mind a statement like that of the philosopher Wendy Brown, who writes in a recent book that faculties at universities, quote, are obliged to help students understand why no value system is ever true. Now, Brown at least sees this as a task, something to show or prove, so her nihilism is considered. In contrast, my impression is that most faculty, especially in law schools, just assert or strongly imply that no value system is ever true. This is the unconsidered skepticism of the law school classroom. Maybe the worst example of reflexive nihilism, and really the examples could be endless, is Cass Sunstein's dismissal in 2004 of the classic law review article by my teacher, Charles Black, defending Brown versus Board of Education, the lawfulness of the segregation decisions. The setting was that the renowned legal scholar Herbert Wexler had criticized Brown for not following what he called neutral principles. Wexler argued, if the freedom of association is denied by segregation, integration forces an association upon those for whom it is repugnant. So it was not neutral. You can imagine that Black, who was part of the team that argued the Brown case, found this line of thought utterly outrageous and had to respond. But Black wrote in his usual restrained, almost aw-shucks style, that the 14th Amendment forbids disadvantaging the Negro race by law. It was surely anticipated that the following of this directive would entail some disagreeableness for white Southerners. Sunstein criticized Black for assuming, quote, far too readily that the Equal Protection Clause forbids any intentional disadvantaging of African Americans. Sunstein added, we might even say that Black's confidence about his view of equal protection emerges as a form of self-delusion, a claim of necessity that masks normative judgments of Black's own. That's what reflexive nihilism sounds like. Yes, it is a normative judgment that racism does not have the same validity as racial justice. In Black's view, the 14th Amendment, all of the Civil War amendments, indeed the whole Civil War, must be viewed, yes, that's right, as a claim of necessity, as at least a down payment on precisely the commitment to racial justice. In contrast, Sunstein, like Wexler, believes that all normative claims are equally subjective, all one's own, or at least he strongly implied that here. But who turned out to be right? I would say Charles Black's view of Brown as absolutely necessary, indeed inevitable, and actually quite simple, turned out to be right. Not just arguable, but right. If equal protection does not mean Brown, it does not mean anything at all. I mentioned this episode because it still wounds me, but also because confronting reflexive nihilism is the task of law schools in step two. It is a philosophical and theological task. That is, people have to come clean and defend, not just assume, what they believe. Now, let's get to the most important part, step three. Planting constitutional democracy in sustainable soil. After we acknowledge our commitments with regard to meaning and defend them, how do we enhance the sustainable soil of constitutional democracy and plant ourselves in it? In my imagined step three, the faculty line up and their commitments are as transparent as their CVs. There won't be a purge of nihilists and relativists. I assume that for a time at least, most law professors will remain nihilists and relativists. They will defend that position. But the nihilists and relativists are also going to have to commit to constitutional democracy and the rule of law and help overcome the American crisis in meaning. So, how does the nihilist law professor confront the crisis in American public life? It has to be on the basis of human solidarity, that we are all in this together, and on the compromise position that we can be instrumental in our commitments to constitutional democracy. That is, the nihilist law professor can argue that while human flourishing of a certain kind cannot be grounded in any way, if we want a society of both freedom and order, there are certain commitments, like freedom of speech and religion, that experience shows we must protect. The process of deciding what those commitments are would be empirical, would involve political science, anthropology, sociology, psychology, and all the rest. You would need to build a science of human flourishing. There is no reason that this cannot be done, or at least started, in our law schools. This result is actually not far from some current new thinking about natural law. There could be overlap between the nihilist who supports human flourishing as a human project and the natural law thinker who does much the same out of a certain view of human nature. You might get to the same conclusions. This all would be enormous improvement. But this kind of instrumentalism is just a starting point. I expect that over time, confronting reflexive nihilism in step two will work its magic, and law professors will reject nihilism. We are not really nihilists. Nihilism is a performance. Then we will be ready for some genuinely sustainable soil. Constitutional democracy must be grounded in soil that has depth to be really sustainable. I hope that the recognition of the source of the crisis in step one, the confronting of the crisis in step two, and the resolution of the crisis in step three will not stop at the surface soil of instrumental compromise, but will dig deeper and find actual new ground for truth. Ultimately, for me, that truth is that law must comport with cosmology and phenomenology. After all, we are star stuff, as Carl Sagan used to say. Cosmologically, the first law with the calendar, as above, so below. We are part of the universe, and we are part of the cycle of life that the universe has brought forth. The framers planted our Constitution in the soil of Newtonian physics, and we will have to do the same with quantum physics. We will have to ask, with the theologian Bernard Lonergan, whether the universe is on our side, and with the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, whether beauty is the telos of the universe. We need to take cosmology seriously. Phenomenologically, we have to come to terms with the good of being itself that is shown in the work of Desmond and others, the goodness of being and the demand of that goodness that each of us feels. We always tell ourselves a story in which we are doing good. Even Hitler told himself that story. The new atheists themselves thought it was good for people to know there's no such thing as good. The good that is all around us is the ultimate truth of human existence, that we are in the good, even though its articulations and implications are ambiguous. That good is the phenomenological foundation of law. We need to take it seriously also. I believe that the new sustainable soil of constitutional democracy will eventually reveal itself in these two ways, the cosmological and the phenomenological. There is a lot of work for us to do. I will not be around to see this future, but many of you will be. The era of boredom, conventional cant, and partisan political certainties in law schools is over. The emergency is obvious. The inadequacy of our current efforts to defend constitutional democracy is also obvious. Radically new thinking in law school is needed if constitutional democracy is to survive, and that thinking will come. We are on the cusp of an exciting time in which that new thinking will take place. As Lincoln wrote in a similarly fraught time in 1862, the dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Thank you. So I don't know what happens next, Derek.
If we have time for questions.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for really thoughtful and thought-provoking and original comments. It's a tremendous contribution to our Law and Democracy series. I guess one question I have is, in a very pluralistic society where Americans disagree with each other, not only on politics, but also religion, and where religious believers disagree vigorously with each other on truth, how can we be respectful of that pluralism at the same time as searching for what I think I understood you to be saying was a truth grounded in some higher, for lack of a better word, religious tradition?
This is the general problem. This is the problem that Rawls set forth. How do you resolve differences with people who disagree? And John Rawls assumed that you could never do it by reason, that these differences were irreconcilable. It turns out that he's completely wrong. The only way to resolve differences is to start with the assumption that there is an answer to the question. If you start with the idea that there is an answer to the question and that both of you are in fact in good faith, and this is of course a problem, a different kind of problem that has been thought about quite a bit. But if you assume in good faith that both of you are in fact after the truth and that you are in fact helping each other to discover the truth, that is the foundation of healthy exchange and dialogue, not the opposite, not to treat the differences that we have as irreconcilable centers of power in which you have yours and I have mine. There is no way to talk to someone with that, under that viewpoint, under that overall viewpoint. So it turns out that the problem of pluralism is dealt with by commitment to truth, not the opposite, as Rawls thought. And this was sort of presumed by your question. At least so it seems to me. Yes.
I like very much the point that we have to hope that people can accept temporarily a situation that they can survive and get to the point when the better angels will win the next election, as it were. But I think recent data tells us that we are increasingly choosing to live by those people who share our political views, that the number of swing districts in which one might bounce between perceptions is disappearing, so that once achieved, that status of red or blue is likely to stay in place potentially for decades at a time without real competition at the ballot box because of the separation of political people by geography and by self-identification. I assume that makes the argument that you're laying out harder to achieve, not easier to achieve. How much risk and danger do you find in the self-selection geographically of what we're doing as a people?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. It does make this project more difficult, and it's a very significant event. And I don't think it matters so much whether it's geographical or it simply happens in a single building that people only talk to people who agree with them. So, I mean, in a way, the great reorganization is just physical confirmation of what we see all around us every moment. But I do disagree with the causation. We are that way because of nihilism. It's in other words, nihilism is the reason that we seek out people who disagree with us rather than talk to people who don't agree with us, because we don't expect to learn anything, because we don't believe there is anything to learn. So I cannot offer, and I have not tried to offer, any immediate resolution of our political disagreements. I don't have them. All I'm saying is They arise out of, the form of them arises out of, the hyper-partisanship of them arises out of the idea that there is no point in talking to people who disagree with you. But people like Dr. King, who thought that there was truth and that history was a movement toward that truth, they love to talk to people who don't agree with them. They thought every opportunity to do that was an opportunity for conversion, or better, they would find out that they were mistaken and that they had something to learn. That has to be the starting point. That's the starting point to undo the great reorganization, I think. Yes.
Founding principles were an idea about revolutionary ideas and new ideas and taking existing ideas and putting them in a place that was brand new soil, lack of government. And there was some alleged, or is a commonality in that what was happening at the government, the orchestration, the revolutionary ideas, there was a buy-in in those ideas at the time. And it was those common set of principles that everybody subscribed to. How does that idea relate to the change in religion or secularism as you discussed here?
They were all bounded. I mean, in other words, even the deists shared this idea of the benign universe and the construction of harmony that we could learn from and learn about. I mean, they were, you know, Enlightenment figures. So the end of that, all of that in a sense was what I meant by the grounding on the concept of God or the idea of God. It wasn't in any detail. They had many differences in detail about religion, but they had a very firm orientation that was similar, just as you say. And we have a very similar, we also have an orientation that is very similar for all of us. I mean, we have real common ground, but unfortunately it's nihilism. In my view, and it's the idea that opinions are just subjective expressions, and so you know, we, like they, share a worldview. It's just ours. I don't think is very healthy, and that's what I think we need to change. And I think it can be changed because we didn't vote on the death of God and on nihilism. I mean, Nietzsche said it was something that happened, and he thought it would be a catastrophe. I mean, he said, you know, it may take 1,000 years to bury him. And he thought that it would lead to exactly this kind of thing, only I didn't realize that at first. I had been studying Nietzsche a long time, and it wasn't until, you know, the mid-teens that I said to myself, oh, this is what he meant. This is not some mystery. This is what Nietzsche, and then Heidegger is interpreting Nietzsche, this is what they meant would happen. They didn't anticipate Donald Trump, but they anticipated things sort of like this. So that makes it easier to understand. And suddenly we're not just in the hands of fate or some weird set of events, but it's actually something understandable. And perhaps then something can be done. This is exactly the kind of reaction I get in the classroom. Yeah, yes.
Conversation that I don't know that I like saw seeing the movie that anyone necessarily changed their minds, but they did learn that the person on the opposite side was indeed a human being and had more regard for thoughts that they held, that they was rational, that wasn't just something else. I'm wondering though, in this age of economic inequality, which you mentioned, these wide gaps, how that, could you comment on those wide divides and how that might impact your thoughts?
Well, I'm guilty here. First of all, let me respond to the earlier part as well. These are very important, and that's what I meant when I said studies show that we think our opponents are more extreme than they are, and this is an example. And I also made fun, you know, which is really unfair. I was making fun of this movement by calling it a technique, because ultimately forbearance has to be more grounded than that, I think, although I think these efforts are laudable. Now, in terms of money, I don't think money's our problem. I don't agree with Larry Lessig. I think that he's been mistaken all these years. He's always argued, a Harvard law professor, has always argued that our problem is that the rich control. Well, it's certainly true that the rich control. Marx taught us that. It's a capitalist society, and the rich will have more influence than anybody else. But the rich didn't want Obama. The rich don't want Trump. They've never wanted Trump. He got in office. They cut taxes. Fine. But he was not their favorite. I don't think that money is this problem. I mean, I think those are serious problems, but I think they're epiphenomenon compared to this level, where I think the spiritual problem is worse. So, you know, I don't agree with Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman said the reason for the spiritual collapse of the white working class is the disappearance of jobs in rural areas. But I don't think the data sustain that at all. This is not the Depression. Even 2008 was not the Depression. And the average wage for average people has been going up, not down. It didn't collapse. So if there is, in fact, a spiritual collapse, I think we should say it's spiritual rather than material. But the economists say it's material first. That's a fundamental disagreement. Yes?
I'm thinking about the progression you mentioned, how, in my layman's understanding of philosophy, growing agnosticism of just less so defined institutional religious conception of God, kind of circle back around to a nihilistic, like if there's something out there, some greater truth, maybe it kind of circles back around to actual truth. How would you see that starting back on this general idea of like being based in forbearance and God and having a objective reasoning behind everything? How do you suppose that doesn't just loop back around and a cycle that continues to happen over?
Well, actually, the only reason I'm confident about that is because it doesn't. I mean, not that I've seen. You know, serious philosophical effort, serious thinking don't simply lead to nihilism. In my experience, I think nihilism is actually very unattractive and unpersuasive and has never really amounted to much. Well, of course, that's sort of, you know, this sort of would have to be true, isn't it? It's nothing after all. So I think that if you start with, and this was the point of phenomenology originally and back in the 30s, I mean, the idea was, let's start with our experiences as human beings and what are we actually experiencing? That's what phenomenology is. And of course, the cosmos is that which we are in fact rooted. You know, this is not a matter of opinion. These are just starting points for thinking. And I think if you start with the real, you end up with the real. Now, that doesn't mean you get to God. I mean, and this is an issue that religious people have taken with the book that I wrote. I wrote as a secularist, and I wrote this last chapter that I didn't finish I purposely didn't finish it. I didn't run out of time. Does this bring us back to God? Because it might be, and Bernard Lonergan might have meant this, the Canadian theologian who asked the question, is the universe on our side? He asked that question so that a non-believing culture would have a way to deal with a weighty and important question of existence. And he thought, in a time of decline, if there are groups that wrestle with a serious and weighty question, he called it cosmopolis, those weighty groups would reverse decline, and their efforts, loosely connected, would lead a culture back to health. And that's what I think will happen. I don't think that you know, it just gets worse and worse, because I don't think nihilism is the truth of things. Yes?
I love this. This has been so thought-provoking. I had a question. I may not be understanding entirely your goal. I see lots of evidence that it's not nihilism, and that people are out marching and like they feel things, and it seems like they're feeling more than just, they're fighting for more than just power. Because if they go and they march on the Capitol, they're not doing it power for themselves, they're doing that because they believe in something that's higher. And maybe the idea is that there's a lack of values out there, or maybe the idea is there's a lack of actual God, capital G, out there, but it seems like lack of values is something that we're not lacking. It's maybe information on how to channel those values towards common aims.
No, I think not. And that I understand exactly what you mean. This nihilism I'm pointing to has not made us less dogmatic. It has not made us less committed, but more dogmatic and more committed. But I think the reason for that is that we act, but we don't talk. We don't discuss. We don't engage. Because the people who you're talking about, all of us, that's what I mean when I say nihilism is a performance. I don't think we are nihilists. I think we do have the feeling that what we're doing, saying, and committing to is real and true and just, but we don't have the categories to think that way. That was the point of Stephen Smith's book, Lost Quandary. We have an ontology, which is nihilism. And we're afraid to say, no, I'm standing for the truth. So, and because we won't say I'm standing for the truth, I don't have to confront your truth. I just have to beat you in a game of power. But if we both stood for truth, I would be challenged by your version of truth. Not just challenged by your position on politics, but your understanding. And I would have to deal with it, I think, I hope. There was a, yes.
Kind of piggybacking off this question, what relates to participating in a democracy is the meaning that individuals and groups get from, you know, an ideological, or believing in a political ideology the same as or less than believing in a religious ideology?
Oh, less than. I mean, unless, of course, your politics are just religion by another name. There are different levels. And, you know, politics is not as fundamental a level as religion, which is why people used to have other concerns, believe it or not, other than politics. It used to not dominate American life. It dominates American life now because it's a gigantic power play by everybody. And, you know, it's ultimate. And, you know, it's the worst possible place to be. Politics, you know, C.S. Lewis said something else. He said, politics will give us actual answers to unserious questions. That's what politics is for. I mean, politics is to decide things. And it's good. We have to decide them. But, you know, fundamental questions don't get decided that way. They get decided in a much deeper level. And it's unfortunate that we now live and die by politics. So, yes.
So I wonder about that. So how widespread this belief in dying by politics is among just most people, right? Especially perhaps young people. I mean, in the law school, and in sort of the circles that we run in, I think we view it as pervasive. But how many people are out there that just, you know, whatever? Right? They don't know who their state elected representatives are. They don't know who their local government folks are. They've heard of Trump. They have no idea who sits on the U.S. Supreme Court. They could care less about the Section 3 argument today. How many of those people are out there? What do we do with that?
No. There are a lot of people like that. And I used to say the same thing. I used to say, this is really a problem of elites. I'm even talking today about law professors, after all. It is in part a problem of elites, and elites because elites lead. That's what they do. And it would be good for this country if our elite were worried about nihilism and trying to do something about it. But I no longer have your confidence. I have now seen in the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, that it's infected all the way down. That, yes, people are ignorant, absolutely ignorant of everything, but still have very strong political opinions. And I think the studies now show it, the surveys show it, that the level of engagement may be very low, because after all, we're all angry and upset, and we don't think anything good is going to happen. Even if our own people get in, we don't think anything good is going to happen. Why do you think Democrats feel the way they do about Biden? I think he's too old too. He's older than I am. I did not think I was going to vote one more time for between two people older than I am. The only good thing is it can't happen in 4 years because they'll be dead. So it won't go on, you know, but just because we don't know a lot doesn't mean we can't hate our presumed opponents. And that hatred has gone very deep. And I don't think it's not, I think it's widespread now, unfortunately.
So. Please join me in thanking Professor Quigley.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you. It took me a long time to come up with a question, which is why there might have been silence for a while, because there's just, you've just gone so much deeper than I'm used to swimming. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Where's Rich? I have to give this back.
Yeah, I can help.
Splendid. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you for talking. I'm the editor of People of Water.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. Meet you. And so thank you.
Oh, you know what? I have seen a couple of tweets.
Oh yeah, me.
About him.
It's fun.
But
I mean, we're losing, but it's like fun.
Oh really?
Yeah,
okay. That's good to know. I mean, I'm going back and saying
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah